an extraordinary will and also extraordinary coffers that reinforces a kind of racist denial of self-examination of many of these police departments, which become fiefdoms of hostility towards citizens who pay taxes and black citizens in particular who continue to continue to die and be traumatized in disproportionate fashion. But also the disparities in education. When kids are 7 and 8 and 9 years old being kicked out of school, when black kids and indigenous kids in particular are then put off the roll, you feed them into detention. Detention becomes a feeder into jail. Jail becomes a warehouse for prison. So when we talk about the school to prison pipeline, that's not just a cute phrase generated as a slogan among progressives. That is a description of the mechanics of horror and trauma upon vulnerable black life. And then dealing with
the COVID-19.
COVID-19 is extremely important. Got to deal with that as well.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. Michael Eric Dyson, political analyst, now a professor at Vanderbilt University. And Waleed Shaheed, spokesperson for Justice Democrats, will link to your piece in The Nation, A Blueprint for Social Movements During the Biden Presidency. To watch the inauguration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris today, visit democracynow.org. It begins around 11 o'clock Eastern Time. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have been inaugurated as the 46th president and vice president, respectively, of the United States. A Portland scientist has found evidence that federal officers used copious amounts of toxic chemicals against protesters last year, and in international news, multiple countries in the European Union are imposing harsher mask mandates as a more contagious strain rocks the region. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 20th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. Joseph Biden was inaugurated today as the 46th President of the United States. He was sworn in by Chief Justice John Roberts shortly after Kamala Harris was sworn in as Vice President by Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Harris is now the highest-ranking woman in the history of the United States and the first Black American and first person of South Asian descent to hold the nation's second-highest office. Following the swearing-in, Biden gave a 21-minute address, declaring that, quote, democracy has prevailed, and that, quote, we must end this civil war, red against blue, rural against urban, conservative against liberal, end quote. Biden will sign executive orders on Wednesday and begin other actions to reverse major problems the Trump administration either exacerbated or ignored. He plans to take 17 executive actions today, moving more quickly than any other modern president to dismantle his predecessor's legacy. His first action was to impose a mask mandate on federal property, and he plans to install a coronavirus response coordinator who will oversee vaccine distribution efforts. By reorganizing the currently mired delivery system of the COVID vaccine, Biden hopes to inoculate 1 million Americans in 100 days. The other orders include halting construction of the border wall, as well as rejoining the Paris Climate Accord and World Health Organization. Biden has also promised to overturn the travel ban against Muslim-majority countries, cancel the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline, and move to restrict evictions and student loans during the pandemic. The nation honors lives lost to COVID-19 as the United States' 46th president is set to take office. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we track the transition in uncharted territory.
For many months, we have grieved by ourselves. Tonight, we grieve and begin healing together.
Vice President-elect Kamala Harris and President-elect Joe Biden honored 400,000 Americans dead from COVID-19 at a ceremony at the Lincoln Memorial late yesterday. Earlier, Biden bid farewell to his home state.
Excuse the emotion, but when I die, Delaware will be written on my heart.
Today, Joe Biden takes the oath of office at noon Eastern, and America welcomes its first Black, South Asian, and woman vice president. Mostly lawmakers and guests will attend the downsize ceremony. Americans are encouraged to watch from home due to pandemic and security concerns. The Department of Defense relieved a dozen National Guard members from their inauguration detail yesterday, according to spokesman Jonathan Hoffman.
These are vetting efforts that identify any questionable behavior in the past or any potential link to questionable behavior, not just related to extremism.
President Donald Trump will skip his successor swearing in, the first president since Andrew Jackson in 1869 to do so. Trump had a positive message in his video farewell, but still never conceded nor mentioned Joe Biden by name.
We inaugurate a new administration and pray for its success in keeping America safe and prosperous.
Top Republican leaders will be at a church service at the president-elect's invitation instead of Trump's farewell event at Joint Base Andrews. During his last day as Senate Majority Leader, Republican Mitch McConnell publicly denounced Trump and his supporters for inciting the riots at the U.S. Capitol.
The mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people.
Incoming Majority Leader Democrat Chuck Schumer says an impeachment trial will happen in the Senate. The House has yet to send the article of impeachment to the upper chamber. Kamala Harris swears in Georgia's two new Democratic senators today and her California replacement. And confirmation hearing started yesterday for Biden's cabinet picks. Treasury Secretary nominee Janet Yellen noted she's dedicated her life to economics. And given the greatly increased deficit the administration inherits, she says Biden's nearly $2 trillion stimulus plan is necessary.
With interest rates at historic lows, the smartest thing we can do is act big. In the long run, I believe the benefits will far outweigh the costs.
Senator Josh Hawley, the Missouri Republican who defended Trump's election fraud claims, says he'll delay Homeland Security Secretary nominee Alejandra Mayorkas' nomination. With thousands of Honduran migrants traveling north towards the U.S., Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson grilled Mayorkas over immigration policy.
Coming here for economic gain is not a valid asylum claim. Would you agree with that?
Senator, I believe I articulated the legal theory in it.
Biden is expected to send a proposal to Congress today to restore and expand programs for those seeking asylum and allow DACA recipients to apply for immediate legal residency. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
Immigration groups are reportedly floored by President Biden's immigration proposal that will pave a way to citizenship for an estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants. Suzanne Potter with the Public News Service has more on the story.
On his first day in office, President-elect Joe Biden is pressing for bold immigration reform, proposing a path to citizenship for an estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants. It would apply to people who have a clean criminal record and were in the U.S. before January 1st. If approved, this would be the first so-called mass legalization since 1986 during the Reagan administration. Carlos Guevara with the group Unidos U.S. says there's a lot of pent-up demand for change in the immigration system.
We're pleased and, frankly, floored a little bit by how visionary this bill appears to be. The path to citizenship of 8 years, that is the fastest that we have ever seen.
California is home to 2 million undocumented immigrants, 200,000 DACA recipients, and 55,000 people who hold temporary protected status, all of whom could benefit from the Biden proposal. Opponents say it amounts to amnesty for people who have broken U.S. immigration laws. Cynthia Buiza with the California Immigrant Policy Center describes herself as cautiously optimistic about the bill's potential. She notes the Biden administration has so many crises to attend to, and his party only has a slim majority in the Senate.
We're all for it, but we want the level of seriousness, the political will, because you need to get this policy with Congress.
The proposal would also make everyone eligible for COVID vaccinations, regardless of immigration status. It would make more people in mixed-status families eligible for pandemic relief and would implement job protections in industries that employ a lot of immigrant workers. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
New research shows that federal agents used toxic and potentially deadly smoke grenades multiple times over the summer in their attempts to disperse social and racial justice demonstrators. Dr. Juniper Simonis is a Portland-based environmental biologist and data scientist with the Chemical Weapons Research Consortium. They noticed in mid-July that many of those participating in the nightly demonstrations complained of serious and unique symptoms lasting for several days after exposure to chemical agents. Simonis said, quote, I have friends who are seasoned veterans of the protests and who have been tear gassed a ton. All of a sudden, they couldn't get out of bed the next day, and some were knocked out for an entire week. Along with a group of volunteers, Simonis began collecting munition canisters from around the Mark O. Hatfield Federal Courthouse, the focal point of the protests and where the majority of federal intervention took place. Several retrieved canisters were marked Maximum HC Smoke Military Style Canister and are manufactured by a company called Defense Technology, which sells crowd control weapons to law enforcement. The HC stands for hexachloroethane, a common ingredient in smoke devices that the EPA has classified as a likely carcinogen. Through firsthand accounts, video documents, and photographs from protests in July, Simonis found that federal agents used HC smoke grenades at least 25 times during downtown demonstrations, and at least once at a protest outside the Immigrations and Customs Enforcement Facility in Southwest Portland. Further analysis of the spent grenades revealed the weapons also contained chromium, lead, and zinc, all heavy metals that are harmful to humans and the environment. Zinc, in particular, when superheated and released as a gas, is incredibly toxic and sometimes fatal. In fact, a 1994 report from the U.S. Army Biomedical Research and Development Laboratory documented that, quote, exposure of unprotected soldiers to high concentrations of HC smoke has resulted in injuries and fatalities. It is emphasized that this smoke should never be employed in crowded and enclosed areas. Safety data sheets from the HC grenades list zinc oxide as a hazardous ingredient in previous years, while the most recent versions of the document make no mention of the heavy metal. Researchers fear that law enforcement may be using these devices without a complete understanding of the hazards they pose. The Oregon Department of Education announced relaxed guidelines for in-person instruction for elementary schools in the Portland area and other coronavirus hotspots. Under these new guidelines, state advisements for districts to safely reopen will be determined by a higher infection rate metric than was previously recommended. Districts were warned against bringing back elementary schoolers if COVID-19 infection rates surpassed 100 per 100,000 residents, or if test positivity rose above 8%. Tuesday's announcement eases the requirement for younger kids, allowing a district to offer in-person instructions to students in kindergarten to grade 5, provided the county infection rate remains below 350 per 100,000 residents and test positivity rates do not rise above 10%. Aligning with weekly data reported by the Oregon Health Authority, the revised metrics will allow schools to reopen in several Oregon counties, including the populous Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. The Department of Education says these changes align with recommendations from the Harvard Global Health Institute. The new guidelines do not alter state mandates on distancing and limiting students' weekly personal contacts, and the guidelines will still require on-site COVID testing for symptomatic students and staff, as well as for those with known exposures to the virus. Additionally, multiple new resources to support learning outside, field trips, equitable grading practices, and contact tracing partnerships will be required under Tuesday's revised guidelines. As for older students, health officials maintain that they are set up to interact with many more individuals than younger students, making the transmission and spread of the virus much more difficult to control. The updated guidance will be taking place immediately. In an attempt to speed up vaccination efforts in the state, a mass vaccination site is being set up at the Oregon Convention Center. It opened today and will be running at full capacity sometime next week. Health authorities hope to use the facility to vaccinate up to 7,000 people per day. Vaccines will be free. The Oregon Health Authority reported 3,252 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday, as well as 50 new deaths. Medical-grade masks instead of cloth coverings may become mandatory in a number of European countries. The news comes as the spread of the new COVID variant continues unobstructed throughout the region. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has agreed with other leaders in the country that either single-use surgical masks or filtering face mask respirators like the N95s should be worn in the workplace, in supermarkets, and on public transportation. France is considering a similar mandate to require clinical masks, as even multi-layer fabric masks don't offer enough protection against this new strain. Meanwhile, the vaccine shortage in Europe is ongoing. Italy only received 48,000 of the 400,000 vaccines allocated this week. The World Health Organization announced on Wednesday that the UK variant of the virus has spread to at least 60 countries, 10 more than just a week ago. The South African variant, which is said to be even more transmissible between people, has been reported in at least 23 countries. The world reported over 600,000 new cases of the coronavirus today. To date, COVID has sickened nearly 100 million people and killed 2 million worldwide. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the COVID-19 outbreak at Two Rivers Correctional Institution in Umatilla, Oregon. At 5:45, it's News from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. At 6, it's Rural Roots Rising. At 6:30, Free Culture Radio. Then stick around at 7 for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow, we can expect scattered showers with a high of 47. Today in history, in 1986, the first National Martin Luther King Jr. Day was celebrated. The quote of the day is from Martin Luther King Jr., who said, quote, "We must recognize that we can't solve our problems now until there is a radical redistribution of economic and political power. We must see now that the evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism are all tied together. You can't really get rid of one without getting rid of the others. The whole structure of American life must be changed. America is a hypocritical nation, and we must put our own house in order." Portland and Multnomah County renters will soon be subject to a less tenant-friendly moratorium on evictions for non-payment of rent. KBOO's Sam Bowman has more on the story.
Last Thursday, the Multnomah County Board voted to rescind the county's eviction moratorium, which until then had been the strongest set of protections available for county residents impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. The county's policy, extended near the end of last year, banned evictions for non-payment of rent until July 2, 2021, and gave renters a further 6 months to pay back any rent due, that's until January 2, 2022. The policy did not require tenants to prove or legally declare an inability to pay due to the COVID-19 pandemic, though it did encourage tenants to pay what they could. Early on in the pandemic, a City of Portland ordinance officially committed the city to piggybacking on whatever policy the county put in place, which extended these protections to people living in parts of Portland outside Multnomah County. The board's vote on Thursday, in the board's terms, aligned the county's timeline with that of the state of Oregon. In December, the Oregon legislature passed House Bill 4401, which extended the statewide moratorium until June 30th of this year, but included no further repayment period. It also required tenants to make a specific legal declaration of their inability to pay rent due to COVID-19 under penalty of perjury if they wanted to be protected by the moratorium. This is now the policy in Multnomah County, and by extension, the whole city of Portland. Or it will be on February 1st, anyway. The commissioners and some of those giving public comment noted that the county and its contractors had already made a considerable effort to educate residents about the current county eviction moratorium and payback period, hence the two-week delay of implementation. County Attorney Jenny Madkour argued in favor of rescinding the county policy, saying it would be less confusing for renters, and that the county could create new policies to respond to needs that arise in the future, including a longer moratorium or repayment grace period. During public comment, Marie Allen Clare of the Lentz-based group Oregon Renters in Action spoke in favor of keeping the current policy, citing the possibility of people falling through the cracks.
We get a lot of calls from tenants that are really worried about, one, the declaration of eligibility, because one, a lot of people don't have access to the forms because they don't have internet. And they're very worried, many of them who don't have jobs now, and their companies have went out of business, that at the end of this moratorium, and when people have received the vaccinations and that kind of thing, and we call it into the pandemic, that they still won't have jobs. And even though people really appreciate these temporary measures that kind of put off having to pay back rent. And one, the back rent, they won't be able to cover. And because of the funds that the state allowed, the funds won't cover enough people.
That was Marie Allen Clare of Oregon Renters in Action speaking at last week's county board hearing. Commissioner Sushila Jayapal asked County Attorney Madcore about how the county proposes to respond to the new requirement that renters must declare their hardship under penalty of perjury.
What we're proposing to do is to rescind our ordinance effective February 21st. That means that immediately as of February 21st, if they don't submit the declaration, they are subject to eviction. If we were then to, in March, put back into effect something that says you don't need to have a declaration, in that interim period of time, tenants are still subject to the risk of eviction.
So, possibly. I think the important thing here is that the tenants can put forward that declaration at any time. So even if eviction proceedings have started, they can, at the courthouse, put in that declaration.
Other than the grace period, the other differences, the other sort of weaker protections go into effect immediately. The notion that we can, down the road, change or adopt a new ordinance that puts protections back in place still leaves people unprotected in between.
There is a possibility that that can happen. I think depending on the issue we're trying to solve, we have a lot of legislative tools available to us. So we have options, but there is no doubt that there will be instances where people are in really tight and really tough spots. And I don't know that any legislative scheme, ours or the state's or all of them combined together, are going to be able to fill all of those gaps.
That was County Attorney Jenny Madcore answering Commissioner Sushila Jayapal at last Thursday's Multnomah County Board hearing. At that hearing, the board voted 3-2 to rescind its COVID-19 related tenant protections in favor of a new state policy that does not include a rent repayment grace period and requires tenants to legally declare their inability to pay due to the pandemic. Jayapal was one of the two no votes, along with Commissioner Lori Stegman. Commissioners Sharon Myron and Jessica Vega Peterson, along with Board Chair Deborah Kafuri, voted to rescind. For KABU Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
Yesterday, the Federal Energy Resource Commission upheld Oregon's denial of a water quality certification in Coos Bay. The ruling denied the proposed Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas export terminal in Coos Bay, as well as its feeder pipeline, the Pacific Connector. Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality originally denied the permit, without which the project's owner, Calgary-based Pembina Pipeline Corporation, was unable to move forward. That was in May of 2019. Senator Ron Wyden said on Tuesday, quote, "Today marks a big win for protecting the South Coast because it reinforces our state's environmental laws and reflects local community input." 15 years after the controversial LNG terminal and pipeline were originally proposed, Tuesday's decision still leaves the company free to reapply to the DEQ for certification. In related news, the Washington Department of Ecology has denied a request for a shoreline permit required to build a $2 billion methanol plant in Kalama that would convert fracked gas to methanol and export it to China. KABU News poet Dan Raphael is cautiously ecstatic.
Ding dong, the Trump is gone. So let's breathe a sigh of relief for a day or two, take off our Eeyore costumes and dance in the frosty sunlight. Maybe COVID, aka the Trump virus, will go away. The Postal Service will be happily burdened with all those checks to deliver. The Defense Department will say, a 20% budget cut? Make it 50. And the mill and billionaires will demand to be heavily taxed, spreading their wealth to all in need. Spring could start next week. White supremacists could remove the fear and hate from their hearts, and your neighbor with a yard full of trash will see the value of order and beauty. But Trump is just a symptom, and problems take at least as long to cure as they took to cause. Let's stop digging deeper and start climbing up. Let's turn the bricks of walls into shelters, throw open windows, doors, and gates, and experience the joy of working together to fix what some feared would always be broken. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
The Navajo Nation Office of the First Lady and Second Lady hosted a community event to discuss human trafficking and exploitation, which disproportionately affects the tribal nations. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation Office of the First and Second Lady is hosting an event Tuesday to address human trafficking and exploitation. Fafilia Nez is First Lady of the Navajo Nation.
We are hosting a virtual event just on the topic of human trafficking. And just to really give, it's almost like a human trafficking 101 virtual event, just to give the very basic information to community members about what it is and how to kind of spot, you know, some of the things that you can look for within either your own family, your nieces, nephews, or within your own communities when you go out to different places or even into border towns for doing shopping or anything like that. You know, some of the things, these things happen around us, but we don't necessarily know what is going on because we don't know what we're supposed to be looking for.
Presenters from the Global Center for Women and Justice, Navajo Law Enforcement, Health and Social Services, and state agency representatives from New Mexico and Arizona are expected to participate. The webinar is being streamed on YouTube on the Navajo Nation Office of the President's communication channel. As President-elect Joe Biden prepares to take office Wednesday, the leader of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe is urging the next administration to honor treaties and remember Native nations. Chairman Harold Frazier congratulated Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris in a video message Monday from the Cheyenne River Reservation in South Dakota, standing outside next to the tribal flag on a snowy, windy day.
Many times, us Indian people have been left behind. Like driving a bus. It's our bus, we own that bus, but yet us Indian people are always put in the back of the bus. It is time that we are in the front of that bus. Now we are driving our bus. So as we move forward, your administration, I really hope that you consider and never forget the Indian people of this country. We were here first.
Frazier then honored Biden and Harris with a song of gratitude. Biden and Harris will take part in an inaugural event Tuesday night. A ceremony is being held in Washington, D.C. to remember the hundreds of thousands of Americans who died from COVID-19. The Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians in North Dakota is making its own hand sanitizer for distribution to the community after facing supply shortages during the pandemic. KFYR reports the tribe partnered with a company in Florida to develop the hand sanitizer. The tribe's expected to begin mass distribution in the next few months and will also be reaching out to others across the country in need of a supply, including other tribes. A camp has been set up next to construction of the Enbridge Line 3 project in Cloquet, Minnesota. KBGR-TV reports about 24 people set up the camp in opposition of the project. Indigenous-led movements have been taking place at various construction sites in northern Minnesota since work began in early December after state regulators approved the final permit for the pipeline replacement. Tribal and environmental groups are vowing not to give up fighting the project, saying it threatens water and the environment, while supporters of the project point to jobs and an economic boost. Some Minnesota tribes and environmental groups filed a lawsuit in December seeking to halt the project. Laura Waterman Whitstock, community leader, journalist, and co-founder of McGeezy Communications in Minneapolis, Minnesota, passed away over the weekend at age 83. She's being remembered for her decades-long work advocating for Native journalists, Native radio, and youth development. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 20th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Sam Bowman, Dan Raphael, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, and Mary Sherman. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBU programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kbu.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBU News in Depth. We're discussing the COVID-19 outbreak at Two Rivers Correctional Institution in Umatilla.
KBU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
These men were not given a death sentence. I mean, like, what do you do? It's like a zombie apocalypse in there. They're hoping once these men go behind bars that we forget about them, and they're not forgotten.
The United States has not done a particularly good job of handling the coronavirus when compared to other countries. The state of Oregon has fared decently compared to other states, but adherence to CDC guidelines for stopping the spread of the pandemic is challenging in Oregon prisons. Loved ones of those imprisoned across the state have raised red flags about how COVID is being treated within the carceral system. Not only do adults in custody, or AICs, sleep in close quarters with each other, some allege they have been sent to work while showing COVID symptoms. Not only do adults in custody, or AICs, sleep in close quarters with each other, some allege they have been sent to work while showing COVID symptoms, and worse, not treated or quarantined long enough when they test positive for the virus. Over 600 inmates at Two Rivers Correctional Institution, or TRCI, in Umatilla have tested positive for coronavirus, and 304 of those cases are active. That makes Two Rivers the largest COVID outbreak in the state, according to data from the Oregon Health Authority. The Oregon Department of Corrections, or DOC, has reported 5 inmate deaths at TRCI in the last week. James Bennett is an inmate at Two Rivers, and he believes there may be more deaths than have been reported. I spoke with Heather Bernhardt, Bennett's fiance, about his experience battling coronavirus in prison.
I know it was around December 10th, there was a transport from, I believe it was Deer Ridge Correctional Institute to Two Rivers, and very quickly the positive cases started to increase. And I'm trying to get my dates right, but right before Christmas, I believe it was that Sunday, himself and a friend that he works with in the OCE laundry that does the laundry for several Washington hospitals and a couple Oregon hospitals there at the facility, himself and that person and another person all had, you know, varying degrees of a temperature. And just were just not feeling quite right. And we're told by the nurse, oh, well, until your fever is over 101, you're fine, go to work. Totally ignored any symptoms when they were told they had to go to work. And because they tried to call out sick, and they basically wouldn't let him, told him he had to go to work. So that Tuesday, after that Sunday, he's in Unit 22. Which is honor housing and also has medically vulnerable people there. And that Tuesday after that Sunday, and I'm going to look at the calendar and double check my date here in a minute, the first person on that unit tested positive. When they got back from work, they tested the entire unit. So they let them stay at work knowing there was at least one positive case on the unit. They came back around noon and tested the unit, and his friend Josh came up positive along with, I believe, one other person. Josh was not removed from the unit until about midnight that night. This is a unit of 80 to 88 people in an open dorm. They share like 4 toilets and that sort of thing. So they're all sharing stuff in between, and it's, you know, they sleep 2.5 feet away from each other. Supposedly the unit was put on quarantine according to the official report from DOC, The next day, they were still told for several days, probably for close to a week, they were still going to work with more and more cases on that unit popping up. When he told me this, I called, he gave me the list of the hospitals that they work for. I called all of them to tell them that CDC guidelines weren't being maintained. And then I also called a woman and spoke to a woman at OCE Laundry at the main office, like their corporate office. And she told me, she admitted to acknowledging that those rapid tests are not always accurate, and that because there can be several days in between exposure and testing positive, the doctors recommend waiting 4 to 5 days before going and getting a test. And she's like, well, as long as they test negative, they'll go to work. That's our policy. He finally tests positive on January 4th, was kept at the facility for several days. It wasn't until the 8th on Friday morning he was transferred to Eastern Oregon Correctional Institute for quarantine, but only kept there for a week. So he didn't get a full accurate quarantine because he'd been kept amongst people that were testing positive and being exposed, and these workers were going back and forth. And mind you, when these workers that have been exposed, heavily exposed on Unit 22 go to work, they cross with other units that work in the laundry as well as going out to get their trays for breakfast and lunch. So they're exposing the kitchen workers who then go back to the rest of the prison, and they're exposing those other correctional officers and staff that work within the with the kitchen workers. He was sent back Friday morning, the 15th, after he probably shouldn't have left Eastern Oregon, to be quite honest, because I believe it was the 14th he started to have severely high blood pressure. The nurses, I do want to preface this, that the nurses and the staff at Eastern Oregon, in the quarantine unit at least, took very good care of him and did what they're supposed to, and were amazing from his standpoint, comparatively, certainly. And then so since he was back at Two Rivers, he's had consistently high blood pressures, as high as 180 over 84 on the 16th. He's had to beg them to check his blood pressure, and they're saying, well, we're not going to write this down. So there's no actual documentation of him having this blood pressure. So he's not somebody that complains about medical stuff. Yeah, so he's scared. You know, blood pressure, like, that's not good. Being ignored is not good. Told me the other day, I believe it was the day he went back to the unit, that there was at least two men on the floor puking when the nurses came in for what's called medline. And the CO, you know, the correctional officers are looking at the guys on the floor and looking at the nurses, ignore these guys. Supposedly a man that had been taken to the, it's called, you know, segregation, the hole where they're putting people with COVID. He had a really high fever and was struggling to breathe, and was told, oh, put a hot, you know, cold washcloth on your head and we'll see if you're here in the morning. And apparently that man died in his cell. I don't know if he died that night, but he is now dead. They have only officially reported 4 or 5 deaths, but James believes there's as many as 9 that have happened at Two Rivers just in the last 2 weeks.
Now that Bennett is back at Two Rivers, his concerns about coronavirus and how it can spread through inmates working in the laundries hasn't ended. Here's an excerpt from a January 15th phone call with Bernhardt.
Knowing that I have been properly quarantined while housed at EOCI for a week, and had basically became asymptomatic after experiencing the symptoms of over a week, I did not want to be re-exposed. And absolutely, now I'm being brought back here to Two Rivers again, housed back into Unit 22. Since we had left Unit 22 the previous Friday, no other inmates had been moved out of this unit. There was five of us that left this unit last Friday and sent to EO to be quarantined, and now we're being brought back. And the inmates that were left here and that are currently still here, that have shown signs and symptoms of COVID and tested positive for COVID, are still housed here, and now I'm being brought back in again to their presence. And several of the inmates have already expressed to me this morning that inmates are experiencing extreme symptoms associated with COVID, and they're not being removed or even being checked out by medical. They put me back in this unit, and this is still passing. And not only, it's not just me. All these guys that are going to work, they're going to work with the other units now. They're so desperate that they went and hired a bunch of new people. They just told them, hey, if you guys want to go to work, hit your buttons, and these guys go back to work in the laundry. And now they're all working the laundry again together, all the units.
Because OCE makes money. They make money from them. I believe there was two prisons alone that made millions last year for DOC in the state. They don't want to lose their money. At the end of the day, that's where it's coming from. You know, they have these negative false, you know, they have these negative rapid tests, and instead of following what CDC guidelines, you know, and half the time it's a shot about whether they're supposed to wear masks or not supposed to wear masks. Half the unit officers wear them, half of them don't. I'm not saying that the laundry shouldn't have been kept open, but it should have, I don't know what should have been done, but that unit completely should have been on quarantine. Since December 10th, when that transport from Deer Ridge has gone down, at that point, the total number of cases that had happened since the virus started and first hit DOC here in Oregon, it was right around 250, 260 cases. Since then, we are now over 400 cases just from December 10th alone. So it has tripled.
The Oregon Department of Corrections was reached by email for comment. Operations and Policy Manager Zachary Erdman wrote, quote, DOC employees are making decisions based on medical and operational expertise, but as always are limited by institution design and designated COVID-19 positive bed availability across the state. At this time, TRCI is housing COVID-19 positive adults in custody on general population units. Those who have tested positive are cohorted away from other AICs. We have policies and procedures in place in order to protect the health of the general population AICs. Housing units that have had positive cases, all AICs in those units are being offered testing, sanitization, mask wearing, social distancing to best ability is still taking place. AICs requiring medical attention beyond what can be provided have been moved to outside medical facilities / hospitals. All people entering a DOC institution are screened for COVID-19. Upon entering the institution, a control point staff member takes the employee's temperatures and will ask employees questions about COVID-19 symptoms. These include fever, cough, shortness of breath, chills, repeated shaking with chills, muscle pain, headache, sore throat, and new loss of taste or smell, end quote. Bernhardt says it can be hard to advocate for adults in custody when it comes to coronavirus and making sure CDC guidelines are followed.
It's not easy because, first of all, just getting the general public to follow guidelines is hard enough, and then you've got this huge population of people in there, and DOC, even before coronavirus, if you have an issue, you get passed around and around in circles. There is a current class action suit going on against DOC as a whole. So, of course, DOC is being real careful about what kind of advocating they're letting family members, you know, what kind of information they're willing to give or receive. When I did try to call the prison directly, I got passed around and around. that's why he had me. I tried to pass along his concerns to the officer of the day. They wouldn't answer my phone calls. I went around in circles with them. I leave these guys messages and don't get any calls in return. So I think it's just it's a DOC thing in general. It's a mindset that they're hoping once these men go behind the bars that we forget about them, and they're not forgotten. Some, unfortunately, are by their families for whatever reasons, but many of these men have family members that love them, and some of them are just, we don't. I guess the most misunderstood part is who do we talk to? You know, one person says to call this person, you call that person, you get passed off, and nobody wants to take accountability.
Bernhardt had this advice for those interested in advocating for coronavirus protections for inmates.
Call your senator, call your representative, call the governor's office. You know, if you care, write emails, write letters, picket outside, you know, the governor's office in Salem. A lot of other states have let an enormous amount of men out due to coronavirus. I know that I'm from New Jersey, and in the state of New Jersey alone, they've let, I think, over 2,000, I think it's close to 2,000, I'm not 100% of the numbers, but way more, thousands, you know, hundreds more than Kate Brown had let out. Don't ignore it, you know. These men were not given a death sentence. You know, yeah, they did a crime, and they're there, and they're doing their time, and they're doing what they're supposed to do, and then having to deal with this on top of it, and then not having the people that are supposed to be protecting them protect them. So it's a possible death sentence.
We've been speaking with Heather Bernhardt, an advocate for the safety of inmates in the face of coronavirus. She is also the fiancée of James Bennett, who is in custody at Two Rivers Correctional Institution in Umatilla. Find more information about this story on our website at kabu.fm. For KABU News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.